You're listening to James Breslow on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Good afternoon and welcome everyone to the James Breslow Show. Happy to be coming to you live from beautiful Southern California. It hasn't fallen into the sea yet. It hasn't collapsed yet under the weight of crime and homelessness, but it's on the verge of it. However, we've got important elections coming up here in Los Angeles in November, and I know Angelenos are going to do the right thing and vote out the progressives, even though the primary indicated that they have no intention to do that. Our one hope for Mayor Rick Caruso, billionaire businessman, former Republican, looks like he's down about 60-40 to the progressive candidate, Karen Bass, who lost in the black female for vice president sweepstakes to Kamala Harris. So that's pretty scary. A number two to Harris. That's who Angelenos right now favor to be their next mayor, even though they identify crime as the number two biggest problem in the city and homelessness as the number one problem in the city. They trust Congresswoman, former community organizer, progressive, Karen Bass, to come to the rescue. It's not as if her views are so different than the current administration. In fact, we have progressives already running the city. The mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, who can't even get out of his job to go take a post in India because he can't get the approval of his own party that controls the Senate to approve his nomination as ambassador. So he's stuck here in LA and we're stuck with him. We got him as a progressive. And then we have 14 out of 15 city council people, all progressives, all which led to the rampant crime and rampant homelessness that we have here in Los Angeles. And Angelenos, based upon the vote in the primary, where one third of them approximately came out to the polls, they put number one and two in place heading to the general. Number one coming in with what appears to be approximately 60% of the vote, Congresswoman, community organizer Karen Bass. Number two choice for Angelenos, Rick Caruso, former Republican, then independent. Then 2 weeks before the campaign started, he became a Democrat. So we all know what's going on there. He knows that it's impossible to be elected as a Republican in Los Angeles. So he's a smart businessman. He calculated and said, you know what? I can't be a Republican. I'm going to become an independent. And then he decided, you know what? I'm not going to leave anything to chance. I'm going to actually put a D next to my name just so I don't get screwed by people who simply check the box Democrat when they vote, which appears to be truly, in fact, what Angelenos do. Don't seem to be smart enough to scratch below the surface in light of the 60% vote for Karen Bass. And by the way, it's only getting worse and worse. They're still counting the votes. We don't vote here in one day in California. We vote over the period of weeks, and then we count the votes over periods of weeks. So we're still counting the votes from the election that took place a few weeks ago. And the more they count, the better Karen Bass does. She's killing it in the mail-in balloting. Some people would say, that sounds really fishy. Can we trust this mail-in balloting process? Is there fraud going on in the mail-in ballots? Well, most likely, no. The reason there's so many mail-in ballots in California that go to the Democrats is the Democratic Party in California is way bigger, way better funded, way better organized than the Republican Party, and they send out all their minions to help collect the ballots from all of their voters. And since most of their voters are in inner city, it's actually even easier for them. It's kind of hard to walk Beverly Hills. It's a lot easier to walk inner cities. You can collect a lot more ballots in a lot shorter time period. So that's the primary reason. The other reason is Republicans in general now do not trust the mail-in balloting. They think that somehow they're going to mail their ballot in and it's going to get lost in the mail, quote unquote. So Republicans refuse to vote via mail-in. I just hope those Republicans remember to vote on Election Day, because the easiest way to vote, in fact, is mail-in. I trust the mail-in process. I mail in my vote typically just to make sure I don't forget to vote. But there's a lot of Republicans out there that don't trust it, and so they wait until the day of, and then I got to assume probably 10 to 20% of them get busy and fail to vote on Election Day, and there's a lost vote. So anyway, Caruso was leading the next morning when we picked up the newspapers, but he's now down by about 7 points to Bass. But if you do the calculation as to all the other votes that went to other candidates, most of those look like they will go to Bass come November. So the billionaire businessman who spent $40 million on his campaign compared to just $3 million for Bass is down 60-40. He's got a lot more work to do. He's got plenty of money. I just hope that he is willing to spend it, because he's going to have to spend at least another $40 million to wake up Los Angeles to the problems of our city and what caused them and who we need and who is able and capable to fix them. That's my take on the news on TNT Radio.
Checking off the boxes.
Established, reputable.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
We have a fabulous guest for us today. Thrilled to have him on the program. We were supposed to have him on, I think it was last week, and there was a snafu, so I sincerely apologize for that, but happy to now have him on, Matt Lohmeyer. Matt, are you with us?
I am. Thanks, James, and no worries.
Hey, buddy, appreciate it. So let's give a little background on you, and I've been dying to talk to you because, you know, I've been involved with the STARS movement out of the Air Force Academy, which is opposing radicalization in our military. It's just been, the more I dig into it, the more shocking it becomes. And then you came out with your book, which really has helped bring this to the fore, but a lot more work needs to be done, I think, for Americans to really understand what's going on. But you were a graduate of the Air Force Academy. You were a lieutenant colonel in the Space Force, which used to be part of the Air Force, and now it is its own military branch. And at that time, correct me if I get anything wrong, you write a book that is published while you're still serving as a lieutenant colonel. And the name of the book is Irresistible Revolution: Marxism's Goal of Conquest and the Unmaking of the American Military. That was released while you were still in the military and caused some problems for you. Tell us about how that all came down. What caused you to write the book, and then what happened next?
Yeah, you did get all of the facts right. I was a lieutenant colonel at the time I wrote the book, and in fact was in command of a space-based missile warning unit for the Space Force, and had, before coming into that, flown F-15s and was a T-38 instructor pilot for the Air Force. In all of my time, oh, by the way, let me put in just a 30-second at most plug for the organization that you just mentioned, STARS. I think in the last year and a half, as I've been recognizing some of the dilemmas we face in our military, I've worked very closely with the retired military veterans who founded STARS. They are the best, most talented group of people in any one organization with which I've worked in the past year. They're just thoroughbreds, and they're patriots who care about their country. They care about the oath that they took so many years back, and they've done a lot of work without pay. I mean, these guys have essentially come out of the comforts of retirement to try and help wake Americans up and educate them about some of the problems we're facing with the politicization of our military. And I think everyone in the country should know about them. But they've done tremendous work. So I'm glad you're having them on your show. But what I
saw, and I think their website, I think their website is STARS with two R's, stars.us.
That's right.
Yeah, stars.us.
Yeah. So to your question, how did I come to write a book? You know, no one really wants to write a book. At least most of the circles I've ever run in, no one really wants to write a book. And I didn't want to write a book, although I like to read. But I was in a unique position in command. I recognized as a commander and as a lifetime member of the military, the importance of keeping our military organizations, roughly speaking, apolitical on the one hand, but also seeing a surge of what I recognized as Marxist-rooted critical race theory in the form of diversity, inclusion, and equity programs and training at our military bases. And fortunately or not, at my base, it was like DIE on steroids when I came into command. And I had a somewhat activist-based commander who really used his platform to push a political agenda. And if you can imagine, if you're listening and thinking, what exactly do you mean? I mean, the stereotypical oppressor versus oppressed narrative, and in this case, it was racially based, that you've heard so much of in broader mainstream societies, really, especially since George Floyd's death and some of the activities of the Black Lives Matter movement. But that stereotypical narrative that is anti-American, anti-Western or Judeo-Christian values was being pushed from a uniform wearer, from his official capacity and his official email address, sending out videos, emails, articles that were indoctrinating young troops to distrust one another, to be skeptical of one another based on race. And we took a lot of time off of training for our actual operational mission so that we could talk about how to fix our systemic racism, our white nationalism, or white supremacy. And you can imagine what that does to any organization, but especially those that don't think those things have anything to do with their mission. It starts to fracture the force, sow discontent, disincentivize the service. And that's what I was seeing that led me to write a book.
Tell me again who this person was and what his position was.
Yeah, the person, it's no secret really now within the military community. Certainly all the military leaders know about it, although I did not mention him by name in my book. I was very careful not to publicly call out by name our senior military leaders. I tried to do everything as legally as I possibly could, but it was a colonel, base commander, a black gentleman, as friendly as can be, but left-wing activist. You mentioned vote out the progressives. Well, he needs to be voted out of our military by our senior military leaders, but he was a colonel at the time this was happening. And at the time that I was relieved of my command for writing this book, identifying Marxist ideology run amok in the military, he was promoted to his first star. And so he sits in a newly promoted position. He's still teaching the same crap, and he's more careful. he's watching carefully the forum, but I've just seen a video of him talking about these issues, and this is not going away, despite the fact that many Americans and service members are waking up to just how divisive this stuff is.
So you mentioned DEI, which is diversity, yeah, equity, and inclusion. Not everybody is aware of that acronym, even though it now is pretty much everywhere. I mean, find me an institution larger than, you know, a few hundred people that doesn't have a diversity, equity, and inclusion officer, whether it's a private company, whether it's the military, whether it's a university, whether it's probably a grade school. For all, it would not surprise me in the slightest if Los Angeles grade schools have a diversity, equity, and inclusion officer. What a great job to have in an industry that has just come out of nowhere. But it's essentially, you could also call it a communist officer, because what I point out is equity is not about equality. It's about equity, equal results, which is basically affirmative action. Equal results is basically communism. That's what communism is that everybody gets the same thing, regardless of what the input is, the output is the same. Give us a quick history, if you could, about DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion in the military. When did this first pop up? When did these positions first come into play?
Well, I think the idea of the formation of such positions dates back to the last Obama-Biden administration. In 2011, there was a Military Leadership and Diversity Commission, I think is what it was called, that most service members who wear the uniform of their country were unaware of. I mean, I'm talking like 99.5% of our service members had no clue this was taking place. But the Obama administration had under his administration, the Secretary of Defense had created this committee to go through all of our DoD regulations and instructions and make sure that certain definitions were changed of words about diversity, about inclusion, about equality, now equity, to make sure that moving forward, we would start to implement it via trainings, some of this agenda. Now, that didn't really take effect until many years later. In fact, I was unaware that any of that existed until I started studying, researching, and writing my own book, because it hadn't trickled down to the operational level of our Air Force and Space Force units. It just, you know, politics and race identity politics and so forth wasn't a staple of the military work environment or the military experience. But after George Floyd's death, the same fervor for progressive social justice activism that you saw smashing windows, stealing things, and violating people's rights in this country was also unfortunately mirrored within and all throughout our military services of at all ranks. It was pushed down from senior leaders in uniform. It was mirrored and parroted by the youngest of our service members who have social media platforms. And they were simply, you know, retweeting or restating things they were watching their heroes because they likely hadn't been taught any better. I mean, when BLM was taking to social media, chanting for Atlanta to burn to the ground, our service members were retweeting it and liking it. And so you had a really interesting phenomenon. And because of the climate of fear that we had created for ourselves within the services, claiming, for instance, that we have a terrible racism problem, what we had done in the year before that had set ourselves up for failure, because many commanders, for example, were unwilling to hold activists accountable for their activism because they might be labeled something like racist or bigot and so on. We've been having trainings about this stuff. And so to trace how long this has been happening, it really takes, and that's why I had to write a book about it, but it takes going back throughout the communist movement, as you've pointed out, to Marx and Engels' 1848 Communist Manifesto, to the first successful revolutionary effort to establish a communist state, which is the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, all the way thereafter to the various communist parties that were established in well over 100 countries in the years that followed, and how that impacted the university setting, how it was kept alive and propped up even after the Cold War ended, surprisingly, in our universities. And, you know, we take a lot of pride educating our senior military leaders in those very same universities for the past couple of decades. And some of that stink has stuck with them. And wittingly or not, they're pushing the agenda.
Yeah, it's funny you should say wittingly or not, because that's exactly what I was thinking about in my head is, you know, when you suggest that there's Marxists in the U.S. military, I think some people might kind of roll their eyes at that. So come on,
of course,
Marxists in the U.S. military. So I mean, how would you answer that? Because, you know, we have seen this shift where they're using race instead of class to push to divide people and categorize people and the oppressed and the oppressor. And a lot of that is Marxist ideology, but a lot of the people that are going along with it haven't even read Marx and aren't even That's aware right. of that. So, yeah, how do you separate genuine Marxist versus unwitting Marxist?
Yeah, well, the genuine Marxist and the unwitting Marxist unfortunately perpetuate the same agenda. And here's what I would say, just a couple of things for the listener to hang their hat on, because I think it's really important. Remember that Marxism has many faces and names, okay? It has shaped its way into culture, largely speaking, because of the many organizations it's established, many institutions in which it's been embedded. It doesn't need to overtly necessarily call itself Marxist to perpetuate a particular agenda. So that's one point. Another point, it's actually worth looking at an interview. Yuri Bezmenov, some of your listeners may be familiar with that name. He was a KGB defector, I think, in the early 1980s. And there's now these popularized YouTube videos that Yuri, he was, I think, standing at a whiteboard and teaching in 1984. And he said something that is more true today than it was towards the end of the Cold War when he said it. He says, you, meaning the Western world, you are in a war and you have precious little time to save yourselves. The whole purpose of the video was about subversion. Subversion and teaching the American people and teaching the West what subversive tactics look like, what subversion is. And the idea or the premise underlying subversion is you don't necessarily know when you're being propagandized. You don't necessarily know when you're pushing the agenda. During the civil rights movement, Marxist organizers tried their best to recruit blacks into their movement. Now I know there's controversy surrounding this now because of some of the investigations that took place, but it's a fact that communists will stop at nothing to try and recruit to their team those who they think will most advantageously pursue their agenda. And they do so so subtly, usually, if they're witting Marxists. They do it subtly, they do it carefully. Now, here's the saddest part. Unfortunately, in the world in which we live, you can even overtly declare your aims these days, just like we've seen in social media and in mainstream media the last couple of years. You can say you're interested in revolution. You can say, as Melina Abdullah has done, I think they're in Los Angeles, one of the Black Lives Matter co-founders, or she's the chapter organizer there in Los Angeles, perhaps. She's also a university professor. She was tweeting in May of 2020, the revolution has begun. It's time to take to the streets. In most empires or kingdoms or states throughout most of human history, there would be severe consequences for even uttering those words, but not in America. You can get away with just about anything, except, of course, if you're Christian conservative or you are a hapless white Christian male at the Air Force Academy right now trying to exercise your rights to do or not do certain things. And so it's a really upside down world that we live in. But subversion is the reason why it's so difficult for us to, at a glance, appreciate this divisive agenda.
Yeah. Well, I did a little research on my own when I was watching some of these Black Lives Matter protesters, and it's fun to look at those signs that are kind of the generic signs. They just kind of have the block lettering and a bunch of people carrying them, and then usually there's a website at the bottom, and then, you know, you just got to freeze it and find that website and go to it. So I did it recently with the abortion activists and found some very fascinating, totally radical websites. But I did the same thing during Black Lives Matter, and yeah, there's some serious hardcore Marxist revolutionary groups that are out there, and there's, you go on their websites and it's all laid out for you. And those were the guys at the BLM protest. I got to take a break. We'll pick it up with your story, what happened to you after you wrote the book. You're listening to the James Breslow Show on TNT Radio.
Free speech is in our DNA.
Experimental vaccines will never change that.
Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Yeah, even there. Never miss out on the news and views of the big issues of the day. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio.
Or download the TNT Radio app for free.
From the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Wokeness is infiltrating churches, and people don't really know what's hitting them.
Critical race theory assumes that racism is everywhere. It is in everything. These ideologies have crept into the church.
I have grown up with this invisible kind of bag of privilege.
And I know, as a white pastor, I have blind spots.
Reparations fits into the scope of the gospel.
It's a racist worldview. You're swinging in racism.
The social justice warriors say, if you're white, you are racist. And if you say that you are not a racist, then you have to be a white supremacist.
I see within evangelicalism today an attack on the very gospel itself.
Social justice doesn't have to do with justice, it has to do with Marxism.
Wokeness is now the dominant academic paradigm on many university and college campuses.
Many of our Christian universities have fallen prey.
I went to an all-black school, raised in a black context. Everything was oppression. White people are racist, cops can't be trusted, and this world is not for us, it's against us. We felt like the government owed us. I have a family, I have children, and I don't have a job. I was just, it was at the darkest point in my life.
because I was white, would we have to divorce and separate due to my skin color?
Christianity enables people to find forgiveness and redemption. However, Marxism is completely vindictive.
There is no redeemer and there is no redemption in the religion of anti-racism. I believe that the evangelical church today is going to have to make a decision. Are we going to submit to the culture, or are we going to remain true to the faith and take the consequences?
How the left is stealing your church. The invasion of the gospel of woke at salemnow.com.
For the news and talk you can't hear anywhere else, it's TNT Radio.
And we are back on the James Breslow Show, speaking with the great Matt Lohmeyer, retired lieutenant colonel from the U.S. Space Force and author of the book Irresistible Revolution, Marxism's Goal of Conquest and the Unmaking of the American Military. People are waking up to learn that this takeover is not just our universities, but yes, it has extended to the military. And as that ad was just reflecting, something you don't talk about that much is the takeover of the churches. And that's absolutely happening also. I want to dig more into the book, but also go back to your story, because it is a pretty incredible story to release a book like that while you're in the military. I mean, what kind of concerns did you have in releasing it? I assume you knew it was going to probably ruffle some feathers at minimum.
Yeah, well, I certainly thought long and hard as I was writing the book about both whether or not to publish the book, but also the potential repercussions for the publishing of the book. And what it's important to point out that I didn't just write a book and blindside senior leaders. I had spent many months before, while Trump was in office. In fact, it was probably August of 2020 that I began to share with my senior leaders all the way up the chain of command while I was in command that I was having concerns about the divisive impact of all of our discussion about diversity, inclusion, and equity. And how I recognized how dangerous it was. And what's interesting is that these senior leaders agreed with me that this was a problem and that it needed to stop. And let me see what I can do to make it stop, kind of a discussion. Well, that was true also from the senior leader of our Space Force, who's one of the Joint Chiefs. And he was intent upon, so he said, sharing with his peers in the Joint Chiefs my feedback. A month later, President Trump had actually issued an executive order. It was, I think, September 22nd of 2020, banning the use of critical race theory vocabulary and jargon in our federal agencies and uniformed services. And that was a great relief for our service members writ large. However, at my own base, instead of being so public about pushing the agenda, our base commander simply decided he would be a little more careful about it. So they canceled some of the trainings they had and simply facilitated. You mentioned these political commissars or communist political officers that can be embedded within institutions. He essentially picked proponents of his agenda at the grassroots level, lower ranking members at the base, who could then organize reading groups and continue to pursue the conversation. So that happened. I filed a formal written Inspector General's complaint with the Space Force, which sat, unfortunately, with them during the election season, November, December, January, no action, no interviews. And January 6th occurred, and I received a written response the following day, January 7th, dismissing my complaint about the Marxist CRT that was being taught at the base. And so I thought, you know, this isn't ever going to get changed. If a lieutenant colonel in command can't use his chain of command, a chain of command that knew me well, knew my family, respected me, if I can't affect the change, certainly some airman who's feeling the burden of this divisive ideology, they might not be able to fix anything about it. So I wrote a book. I did it as fast as
I could.
Hold
on. Let me just ask you, in those complaints that you were raising, what were you specifying to them that, look, this is what I'm seeing that is negative as a direct result of these teachings? Not just that I disagree with these teachings, but here is examples of the negative effects it's having in the military.
So I'll just put in a shameless plug right now. I started a show that's on YouTube. Maybe that burns the ears of some of our listeners. I don't know. But It's on every other podcasting platform. In the first, and the reason I bring it up, in the first episode of the Matt Lohmeyer Show, I read verbatim my 7-page complaint that I sent to the Space Force Inspector General's office. I don't leave anything out except for people's names. So the entire complaint is there. And I can say, hey, go listen to that, because that was, you know, Senator Tom Cotton in Arkansas was sent that complaint at the time. I filed it with the Inspector General's office. Senator Ted Cruz and a number of other congressmen who are interested in helping put an end to this, who sit on the House Armed Services Committee and the Senate Armed Services Committee, they were having me send them the documentation that I was submitting, and yet entirely unable to make an impact. And so, yeah, I specifically pointed out conversations that I was having. For example, the Black activist chaplain at my base, they're not always Black, but unfortunately in the arena that we live in, fact, oftentimes they're white. But I had, you know, it's important context, unfortunately, given people actually care to hear these details now, and they might not have 2 years ago, but a Black chaplain activist sat down and had a very lengthy conversation with me in my office as a commander, explaining to me that he understood that all whites were racist because his mama had taught him that. That was his words, not mine. My mama has taught me all whites are racist, and she's not probably entirely right, he said, but I think she's mostly right, and so I'm here to help fix our racism problem. I said, look, there's no greater advocate of the chaplaincy than me, but you're not welcome in my squadron if all you're going to do is preach a racist Marxist ideology to these young kids. I mean, they need you regardless of their religious affiliation, regardless of their political orientation or bent. They need to go to a chaplain in certain sensitive times in their lives for counsel, to discuss in a way that they know is protected and non-reportable. And you're going to lose the trust of many people in my squadron if you push this. Well, he did. So he was organizing Black-only events. The base commander was organizing safe spaces, essentially, for the Black airmen at the base, and having them over to his house, and then talking about how we can fix white racism. Here's another example. The white civilians at his base were called into his office. This was not in the complaint. I learned of it later. Showing them pictures of the Trump administration and asking the white employees, what's wrong with the pictures? And they said, we don't know, sir. You tell us. And he says, they're all white. That's what's wrong with these pictures. We've got a racism problem in this country that we need to fix. And then he'd assign different individuals, government civilians, to work on diversity and inclusion homework that then could be presented to the base. And they were so utterly afraid to come forward and file a complaint because, after all, you might be labeled something terrible, that they sat on it. They lived a miserable life for many months. We can't have that kind of thing going on in our military organization. It shouldn't be going on anywhere in the country, but unfortunately it does. But it will wreck a military. That's why our recruiting numbers are lower than, I think, frankly, we're going to see lower recruiting numbers this year than we've seen in a very long time. And our retention is suffering. I've got friends who are fast burners, who promoted early to lieutenant colonel, who've been in command. They're getting out because they just can't, they didn't sign up to be politicized every day of their lives. It's a really sad time. We need good people in our military, and we have a lot of good people in our military. Yeah. We've got tremendously good people, but there, talk about real oppression. There's a political, ideological oppression afoot right now that is the real issue, and we got to fix it.
Yeah. Well, and I would imagine it goes beyond the race issue, that the military has become politicized. And if you were, for instance, a Trump supporter,
that's right,
that would make you probably a white supremacist. So in that sense, they tie it to race. But, you know, is that an example of something? I mean, I know, yeah, you know, politics aren't supposed to be in the military, but certainly among your friends and cohorts, you should be able to talk politics and who you're voting for and so on. But would being a Trump supporter something that somebody would have to keep to themselves?
Yeah, let me give you a good example of what happened at my own base. And I, you know, it's good to I can share dozens of other stories from others at other bases, but it's perhaps more important for me to share my own personal experience firsthand instead of hearsay. As a commander, one of many commanders at the base, this base is in Denver, Colorado, by the way, we were all called in for a meeting with the base commander during election season. The base legal was there. Our senior enlisted leaders were there. There's probably 50, 60 people in the room. And we were all warned, I think the right term is threatened by the base commander and his legal staff, that if we displayed any public support for the sitting commander in chief, mind you, President Trump, during election season, we might forfeit our pay. And I'll tell you, it was a talk about it again, an oppressive air or spirit. I mean, it takes courage for people to stand up and say, hey, this is out of line. But if no one else is doing it, usually people just sit there and think, okay, well, first off, the military structure, as you're aware, I mean, rank matters. People usually watch their P's and Q's. They're careful how they present themselves. They don't want to be divisive. And yet they've got this stuff thrust upon them. The base commander then shared examples of others in the DOD who had non-authorized photos of the president sitting on their desk, meaning, you know, there's an official photo that's, if you have one of these photos, you better remove it. If you've got a Trump sticker on your car, it better not be showing on this base because you'll forfeit.
Okay. And what about, and what did they say about if you're a supporter of Biden?
Yeah, they didn't say anything about it. But the whole point, of course, they didn't say anything about it. And guess what? Next time he's up for, next time there's a presidential election, I'll bet you $1 million that none of those briefings will be happening at any of our bases across the Defense Department saying, don't you dare support Joe Biden or a Democrat and show any public
But hold on
support.
A second. Your story, I mean, I gotta be honest, your story strikes me as borderline unbelievable. How could they with a straight face? I mean, I understand that there's not supposed to be politics in the military. So if what they were saying is, hey, guys, we've got a presidential election coming up. So really, there shouldn't be paraphernalia associated with the election, regardless of who you support. You know, we like to keep that out of the military because we're focused. That, I guess, would be okay, right?
Okay. Let me clarify so I'm perfectly clear. They said that too, okay, which makes it so difficult for someone to stand up when they slip in the other stuff. I mean, it's like you hear 80% of the presentation. We were in there for an hour and a half, and you hear 80% of the presentation, and you think, okay, like, I get it. That's our obligation. That's in DOD regulation. That's, you know, this is stuff we understand. It's good to have the reminder. And then you've got 15 seconds slipped in a statement. You think, well, I don't agree with that. But then they move past that to sharing real life examples of people who have actually had their pay forfeited. So it's threatening. And like, you know, the dilemma that a service member is in, even a lieutenant colonel, you know, looking back, I wish I was as bold then as I am now. I've learned over, you have to learn enough to be confident enough to be courageous sometimes. And I didn't know enough about the rules, and I didn't know enough that it's time to stand up. You know, I was being fired before it was cool, by the way. So a lot of people are being fired now, but like, you know, that wasn't normal for people to stand up and publicly disagree with senior leaders. And it's time that people do that if they're crossing a line. But I think personal view, and I've talked to attorneys who share this view, you know, he was crossing a line and potentially engaging in illegal activity in what he was saying. But he had a team of attorneys surrounding him. And then there's the race card, you know. And so this is why it's so difficult to eliminate these problems or to address them effectively, is because it's not always just in your face moment after moment after moment. It's subversive. It's blended with a bunch of stuff that you already believe in, like talk of liberty and freedom and equality. It's like, well, what good American does it believe in those ideals? But then there's a twist, and there's new terms, and there's, so boy, yeah, I'm not exaggerating when I say those things, but it was couched among a context of discussion and language that no one could disagree with. And so, you know, at what point do you interject and interrupt the presentation to stand up and say, hey, I don't know about everyone here, but I disagree wholeheartedly with what I'm hearing here, and I think we're off base. That's a hard thing to do. So, and it's easy for me to think now, like, I honestly say today I could do that. And I've done it several times since being out of active duty. But I've also recognized, you know, culturally speaking, if you're wearing the uniform and you're in that room, that's a hard thing to do when you're not one of the senior ranking people in the room. So, you know, that's me empathizing a bit. So it's, boy, but there's a lot of that going on right now.
Mm-hmm. You know, what it reminds me of, and this is basically how it creeps in, and it starts with these diversity, equity, inclusion officers who, you know, got to fill their day. So they got to put on seminars and this and that, and they got to be involved in hiring, and they have to be involved in promotions. And here's a personal experience, and I'll bet you something similar goes on in the military. I was considering a local community college and being a professor there. And I go on their application process. Oh, watch this video. This will tell you everything that that you need to know. And there's the diversity, equity, and inclusion officer talking about the statement that you must prepare to demonstrate your commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And she's clear. She says, and I don't just want to hear, you know, that, oh, you support this, you support that. I want to know the actual things that you have done in your life to support diversity, equity, and inclusion.
That's right.
So it's a litmus test. You got to buy into the BS to even that's be right. considered. And I'm guessing that's also true in the military at this point.
It is true. In fact, it's. I was really hoping that in publishing the book a little over a year ago in May of 2021, this would bring enough attention from Congress and from some of our senior military leaders. Once they were armed with knowledge, I thought maybe they'll be courageous enough to push back. And that hasn't been the case. Although there are plenty of people pushing back, it's just not the right people. I mean, you have to have, once you get above the rank of colonel, it's like, where are all of our general officers on this? It's only the retired ones that are speaking out, of course. And we have now at our service academies, at least at the Air Force Academy, that I can be sure of, I mean, they've put a political officer. It's a D&I officer, diversity and inclusion officer, who wears a purple braid around their shoulder so they can be properly identified in every one of the 40 cadet squadrons, so that now there's a point of contact, a face and a name that people can go wow. to talk about the issues they might be observing among their peers. You know,
they're diversity, equity, and inclusion spies. Right? They're
that's
the
exactly what it is. And it generates a culture of fear on the one hand and a tattletale climate on the other hand. You know, you're going to have people
diversity, equity, inclusion
talking
officer,
about racism.
Yeah, their job is basically to make sure that only leftists are hired or promoted. That's what's pretty much their
job.
Yeah,
you know,
right?
You can say that it comes down to that. They'd never say that. I was forwarded some emails from some service members just yesterday, three of them, in fact, that have gone out in the Air Force, directing the bases to stand up diversity, and they've changed the acronym: diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility (DEIA). Accessibility
okay.
refers to the handicap.
And then should we add a plus to it?
Right, exactly.
Should we add a plus to that, because we know more are coming?
and the B in LGBTQIA plus stands for bisexual, by the way. That's a big problem they're going to have to fix here pretty soon. But
right,
these DEIA councils are now being directed to be stood up at the bases. They will meet weekly and report back to higher level DEIA councils within the DOD too. And then there's reporting that's supposed to go on. This is exactly, James, what you just said. There's reporting that is supposed to go on about their DEIA activities at the base to ensure that we're fostering a climate of diversity and inclusion and so on. And this is what struck me the most. This is what should be, you know, even if you agree with the importance of the diversity and inclusion industry, and I don't, by the way, I think it's communist in its origin. Even if you agree, one of the caveats attending the direction to stand up these councils was that they were to spend no more than 20% of their workday on these initiatives. Our service members shouldn't be spending any time on this stuff, but certainly not 20% of their workday on these initiatives 5 days a week. I mean, they've got critical missions that they need to accomplish, national security imperatives that they train for. And it's like we're entirely remaking. In fact, I'll use this phrase: fundamentally transforming our country and our military. And you don't fundamentally transform anything that's praiseworthy, lovely, and useful. You transform and fundamentally transform things that are ugly and broken.
Yeah, we got to take our last break, and then I want to pick up with your story as to what happened after you published the book. We're talking to Matt Lohmeyer on the James Breslow Show, TNT Radio.
Actor Russell Brand has now become one of the most important voices in the fight against COVID tyranny.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Marano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Marano.
Russell Brand has been known as a socialist and a left-wing Hollywood-type activist. But in the last 2 years, his politics have transformed. He is now one of the most eloquent spokesmen against lockdowns, mask mandates, vaccine passports, the World Health Organization, the public health bureaucracy. Here is Russell's own words explaining about the science.
Whenever there's any cynicism and doubt, you're a conspiracy theorist, you're a nutter, you're against progress, follow the science. We've just heard the problem with following the science is that the science follows the money. That's the issue. Science is a subset of commerce.
Yes, Russell Brand gets it. The problem with following the science is the science follows the money. This is how we end up with Bill Gates-funded experts working at the WHO, then recommending public policy pronouncements and mandating the products that they're funded to mandate. For the Marano Minute, this is Mark Marano on TNT Radio.
My name is Latoya Adams. I served in the Army. Being with paralyzed veterans of America, they have showed me so much is possible.
I'm Sean Castle, served in the United States Army. I went from laying in a hospital bed dying to being a professional wheelchair basketball player. And it started with that one moment where there's life. I am unstoppable because Paralyzed Veterans of America is by my side.
We are unstoppable.
Learn more at pva.org.
When you need to know what's going on around the world and at home, keep it on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And welcome back to our final segment with Matt Lohmeyer. Author of Irresistible Revolution, Marxism's Goal of Conquest in the Unmaking of the American Military. Go Google that book if you want to pick it up wherever you buy your books, and check out his show on the Matt Lohmeyer Show on YouTube. So you had your complaint pending, the many-page complaint that people can see on YouTube. And then you said just coincidentally, right after January 6th, you heard back on the complaint?
Yeah, it was. To be perfectly fair, the letter is dated January 4th, but I received it on January 7th. Okay. And so that's, you people can make of that what they will. But it's like, hey, we're not even sure we want to investigate your complaint because it's election season. We don't yet know the outcome and who will sit in the Oval Office. And so we're going to wait and see the political writing on the wall. And that might determine whether or not we want to hold someone accountable, like an activist base commander, for deliberately disobeying an executive order of the sitting commander in chief. And as it turns out, that commander in chief was on his way out the door and a new one was headed in. And in fact, on day one of Joe Biden's administration, he revoked that old executive order with a new one and re-upped on our country's commitment to the diversity, equity, and inclusion industry. So
I knew that he had revoked Trump's order of no CRT, basically, in federal employment, including the military. Mm-hmm. But you're saying he actually replaced it with a new one, which doubled down on it?
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, it's difficult for even senior military leaders who disagree with the current policy of the Biden administration to get away from this in one sense, because there's so much momentum for these efforts in policy. A lot of them are just simply acting on policy, creating initiatives, trying to implement policy, and they're on the hook to other organizations and they're accountable to report back on their initiatives to implement policy. And so now it does take people standing up and fighting back, but I'll tell you, there's a lot of momentum behind this at the moment. And it's just one of the many ugly things happening.
Remind me, there was it National Stand Down Day? Do I have that right? There was some initiative to basically root out white supremacy in our military on the heels of January 6th. What was that all about?
So Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin is appointed by Joe Biden, and he ends up being confirmed, I think it was in January, the same month that Joe Biden takes office. And there was a policy memorandum that was sent to all of the Defense Department directing a stand down day for discussions on race. There was a certain drop dead date by which every commander was to make sure they facilitated that stand down day. And what a stand down day is, for those that might not know, is, hey, whatever mission you happen to be training for or tending to be, you know, do on a day-to-day basis, you're going to take a knee from that and you're going to gather in an auditorium or in your unit somewhere, and you're going to discuss how it is we can overcome our terrible racism. Now, we knew from Secretary Austin's confirmation hearings and from other policy memoranda exactly what he was trying to accomplish with that stand down day, because he had said that white supremacy within the ranks is one of our most difficult challenges as a military that we needed to fix. But in the memo directing the stand down day, he was not as specific as to say it was to address white supremacy. But the training materials that I received as a commander within the Department of the Air Force, they completely ignored some of the extremism. It was a down day to address extremism. That's how it was characterized. The extremism that had taken place in this country for all of America to see nightly on the news in 2020 was not the subject of discussion. And it wasn't the kind of extremism that Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin thought was important to identify or to educate about. In fact, he pulled from years-old examples where there were one-off examples where some guy was found looking at white supremacy websites, for example. And so he had to be separated from the military. And so there's a number of these guys out there. We know we're coming to look for you. Get this real quick. If I've got 20 more seconds on this topic, let me share this. What that did to the military was sent everyone to the internet, Googling white supremacy organizations, trying, because I was supposed to talk about the KKK and other things. I mean, this was all a part of the stand-up. So I'm Googling. I don't know anything about this stuff, nor do most of ours. And then the DOD reveals publicly that it's going to monitor our YouTube searches and pull data from service members' computer accounts, from their official accounts, from their government workstations and so forth, to see what kind of websites we're looking at. And sure enough, guess what? There's a bunch of white supremacists running around, because look at all the stuff they're Googling. But it's like for two, 3 months, they had been setting everyone up, conditioning them to think that this is a really big problem. And oh, by the way, you're to provide training about this. And now we're going to prove to you with the data that we actually do have a problem. There's far too much interest in this topic. I mean, this is sinister. I mean, I don't think you do that on accident. I really don't. I think that was a very well-planned move to prove a point. And now I could be wrong and all these stars could be aligning in their favor, but I think that that was a plan. And
in all of your many years, in all your many years and time and experience in the military, did you were you serving alongside any white supremacists that you saw?
I am not aware of ever having served next to a white supremacist. And I don't get me wrong, there are, I'm sure, racists and white supremacists in every country, or this kind, maybe not in every country, but in the West. I don't think there are many. And if they happen to serve in the military, I think it's a very small minority, and they probably know better. They'll keep their views to themselves, and you better, you know, and they're going to be held accountable for the same standards every other service member is held to. And it's that they treat all of their peers with dignity and respect, period, regardless of their views. Now, so I don't know any, and I'll point out that the commander of U.S. Strategic Command and the commander of U.S. Space Command, different than the U.S. Space Force, both testified under oath before the Congress about that very question. And both of these guys, who had like a combined 65 years of experience or more in the service, said they've never known of a single white supremacist in uniform during their entire time of service. That's pretty telling. So it's these
yet
are made
it's,
up
yet
narratives.
It's the number one. Yet it's the number one problem facing our military.
Yeah, global climate change, white supremacy, and COVID. I'm not kidding. Those came out in a policy memorandum from Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. It was global climate change, white supremacy, and COVID, and everyone scratched their heads and thought, really? I drive tanks. How do I train for that? I operate space-based missile warning sensors or GPS, or I fly jets. I mean, like, so what exactly is it that I'm doing to help combat those problems? You know, it just,
well,
it
we can't leave,
it doesn't make sense to our service member.
We're out of time. I could talk about this much longer. Maybe we can have you on again, Matt. We really appreciate it. Just so we don't leave people with the cliffhanger, can you just tell us in 20 seconds how your termination came about, if you can?
Okay, here's the quick version. I was fired from my command in May. I was under investigation by the Inspector General's office for 3 months. I lost my pension and was separated from the military in September of 2021. Yeah, 21. I was honorably discharged, by the way, and there was not a single point brought against me as something that I had done wrong. And my current efforts, I've founded a PAC, the Save America's Military PAC. I've got my own show on YouTube that you've mentioned, the Matt Lohmeyer Show. And I try and support the STARS nonprofit that you mentioned earlier, STARS.us, when I can.
Yeah. All right. Well, you're a hero to many of us, most of us. Americans appreciate what you're doing in trying to save our military from this. It's going down a really scary hole. Thank you to Matt Lohmeyer. Thank you all for listening to the first hour of the James Breslow Show. We'll be back with more after the break on TNT Radio.